deal with that in June.
All right, so today I want to talk to you about an experiment that I've just finished on approximating the Jones polynomial. And as most of you may know, the student conference is a yearly thing, and last year, if any of you were here, I talked about the idea for this experiment, and it's taken a year from that point for me to actually perform the experiment, and I have some results for you. So it's called Approximating the Jones Polynomial, a Liquid State NMR Experiment, and the question that we're trying to answer is, can we distinguish between two knots by approximating the Jones Polynomial? So in order to answer this question, I'll start by explaining what exactly knots are. Then I'm going to talk about DQC1, which Osama had already mentioned, which is going to be the model of quantum computation that we're going to use. Talk a little bit about the algorithm, the experiment, results. And finally, I'll answer this question, or at least to the best of my ability. So what is a Jones polynomial? Better yet, what is a knot? So this is an example of a knot. Technically, it's the circle embedded in R3. Anything that looks like this, and in fact, this isn't drawn very well because you should be able to see which strand is crossing over which strand. So I haven't really shown that here. But the question is, in one of the most fundamental questions in knot theory is asking, is this knot here the same as this knot, which we call the unknot because it has no crossings in it? I think it's very clever. So this is a hard question to answer, believe it or not. This is not trivial at all. The way that you can try and solve this is just take the knot and manipulate it, right? Actually move the strands around and see if you can make it look like this. So in order to try and solve this problem, mathematicians have come up with something called a knot invariant, which, just as it sounds, it tells us whether two knots are the same. And the Jones polynomial is one of the best knot invariants. So how are we going to calculate the Jones polynomial? Well, we first need to introduce braids, which is this guy right here. It's a lot like a knot, except our strands are open-ended. So we have four open-ended strands at the top and four open-ended at the bottom. And in order to make this into a knot again, all we do is we just connect the bottom strand to a top strand, like this. So leftmost to leftmost, rightmost to rightmost, and so forth. This is called the trace closure. So if you can see, once we've connected these strands up, we get a knot that looks like this. And if you look at it pretty carefully, if you take this middle strand right here and just lift it upwards, you can see that this kind of falls apart into the unknot. So indeed, this knot here is equivalent to this one. We need a way to characterize our braids. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about every crossing in the braid. Yeah?
How do you make the braid?
It's fairly difficult. The best way to do it would be to look at the knot and then transform it so that it looks like a braid representation that's closed. For instance, from this knot here, you would never choose this braid representation. I just wanted to show for an example. So in a four-strand knot, or in a four-strand braid like we have here, there are three different types of crossings, and in fact there are these three crossings and their inverses, so we have a total of six different crossings. The first crossing I'm denoting by sigma 1, and that just means the first strand is crossing over the second strand. If the second strand was crossing over the first strand, I would call this sigma 1 inverse, like I've done here with sigma 2. This isn't. If it was sigma 2, the second strand here would be crossing over the third. Instead, it's underneath, so sigma 2 inverse, and so forth. So what we end up doing is we use something called the Fibonacci representation, which I'm not going to get into at all. But what that allows us to do is it allows us to map these elementary crossings into unitaries. So basically, the take-home message from this slide is that for every crossing in the braid, I can generate a unitary. And the unitary that's going to characterize this entire braid is just going to be the multiplication of the unitary starting from the top and working our way down. So for this braid, it's going to be sigma 1, sigma 2 inverse, sigma 3. A technical point, these elementary crossings are the generators of the braid group under a few conditions that we're not going to talk about. Something that's fairly important to note, especially when we get into looking at the results, is that you can have several different braids that can have the same Jones polynomial. So a really simple example of that, like we have here, this is exactly the braid we had before, sigma 1, sigma 2 inverse, sigma 3. Like I showed, when we close off these strands, we end up with the unknot. The second braid is exactly the same thing with the exception of this middle crossing. I've changed it from sigma 2 inverse to sigma 2. Upon the trace closure, we still get the unknot. So several different braids can result in the same knot. And so what we'd expect is when we calculate the Jones polynomial for this braid and for this braid, we want them to be the same. So now we're going to kind of step away from, oh, before we step away, yeah. To reduce the number of strands? Can you get rid of the second crossing or the second strand altogether? Okay. So you can actually imagine, we need more erasers. If I had two strands, a two-strand braid, and I closed it off, this is also the unknot, right? So yes, we can eliminate strands. There's no hard and fast rule that I know of like that. But the reason I'm showing you four-strand braids is because for the experiment we have to restrict ourselves to a limited set, and so I've decided to work with all knots we can get out of these four strands. So the computational model we're going to work with is obviously a quantum computer, and we're going to work with DQC1, as I already alluded to. When you generally think of full-blown quantum computers, you think about having initializable input qubits, which means that you can put your input qubits into any state you want. Most of the time, you put them into pure states. You evolve under a unitary evolution, and you measure the output qubits. So in DQC1, as you've already seen, we only have one initializable input qubit. We only have that one top qubit. We still have unitary evolution, and our measurements are projective measurements. This is based on the fact that in NMR, like Osama said, we have ensemble measurements, and that's why we have this expectation value. But it turns out that with this restricted case, we can still perform computations that have no known classical algorithm. And again, like was already mentioned, this is what the circuit for DQC1 looks like. Our input qubit is actually in mostly the completely mixed state with a slight polarization towards the ground state. And I have n qubits in this bottom register that are in the completely mixed state. After performing a Hadamard on this top qubit to get an x, I perform a controlled unitary, and if I measure sigma x and sigma y, I end up with the real and imaginary parts of the trace of the unitary with some normalization factors. Yeah?
Yeah, I guess that's like practice, a real
thing. Which? This one? Well, we do our best to get rid of the polarization. So we perform, we perform pulses on it that destroy the polarization.
Okay.
So,
and if there's
I mean, it will change the output.
Slightly.
Yeah, it's not a big deal. If this is not an entirely mixed state?
Yeah.
No, if this is not an entire,
if you ignore that, it's a random experiment, then you can do whatever you want.
Right, this works regardless of what's in this register.
Yeah.
We put the identity so that we get the trace of the unitary. If we didn't have the identity here, we have the trace of the state that we started with times the unitary. Yeah, to find the trace of the unitary, we require that this is a completely mixed state, completely random. Yeah.
A real experiment can be a problem that's having
random. No, in NMR this is the natural state that we have. We start with this, right? It turns out it's very easy for us to get rid of this term. Right? So that's what we do. We essentially, we start with this and we kill this Z term and we're just left with this guy. And that's very easy to do in NMR. We do it very well. We can destroy polarization very well. It's not so much of a problem. Yeah. There's no known classical algorithm for it. If you think about it, the best really you can do classically is just query your unitary n times. Which grows exponentially with the size of your system. So now that we know what DQC1 is, you believe me, hopefully, that I can find the trace of the unitary, especially in NMR, which I'll explain in a second. We're going to use DQC1 to find the weighted trace of the unitary that describes the braids that I showed earlier. And then we're going to plug it into an equation to find the Jones polynomial, and this is what this V of T is. This is the Jones polynomial. We're not actually finding the entire polynomial. We're only evaluating the polynomial at one very special point. And this is the only point that this algorithm works for. We should note that this algorithm, well, the algorithm that we're using is adapted from Shore and Jordan, a paper that came out in early 2008. And they proved that this is the complete problem for DQC1. And we're just finding a way to implement it. So W here is the rise of your braid. It just tells you how many positive crossings you have and how many negative crossings you have. G is a constant function of the number of strands in our braid. All we really need to worry about is this weighted trace, which is different than what I said we could calculate, right? I said we could calculate the trace. It turns out what the weighted trace is I've written it here, like phi times the trace of the top subsystem plus trace of the bottom subsystem, or subspace, I should say. And what I mean by top is, when this, I actually have three qubits in the completely mixed state. When this first qubit is in the up state, I'm going to call it the top. And when it's in the bottom state, I'm going to call it the bottom. And in the down state, I'm going to call that the bottom. So all I want to do is I want to calculate, you know, phi times the top, the trace of the top, plus 1 times the bottom, where phi is the golden ratio. And how we do that is we actually don't start with a completely mixed state here. We purify one of our qubits. And we purify this qubit to the zero state so that we can perform a rotation. And that rotation is going to give a different weight to the top system, subsystem, than to the bottom, right? Which is exactly what we want. And so, you know, I can rotate this in the very particular way that I want so that when I perform this unitary, I'm going to end up getting this weighted trace out. Yeah. You look concerned. Right. So technically, it's not DQC1. We'd probably call it DQC2, which is actually fairly well-known nomenclature. But the idea is that it's been proven that DQC for k pure qubits is no more or less powerful, no more powerful, I guess is the important one, than DQC1, provided that k grows logarithmically or less than logarithmically with the size of your system. So this isn't a problem. And especially in this system, if we were to have many more maximum mixed qubits, we'd still only need this one pure state. So it's kind of like a constant overhead that we're adding here. All right, so I measure my sigma x and my sigma y, and I get out this state here, which is perfect. It's exactly what I want. I can plug it into my equation for the Jones polynomial right here. Everything else is known, like I said. T is the particular point we're evaluating it at, W is the rise, golden ratio, number of completely mixed states, so in our case it's 2, and kappa is this constant function, which I actually called G of N in the other slide. All right. So now we get to the actual experimental system. I'm performing this in liquid state NMR with 4 qubits, as you saw in the diagram. I'm using the 4 carbons in crotonic acid. These are oxygens, the green guys are hydrogens, and we're going to ignore them. C1 is going to be my top qubit, the one that I prepare, or the one that starts out in the pure state and the one that I measure. C2 is the qubit that I purify and perform the rotation on. C3 and 4 start out in the completely mixed state. Here, just like in Othama's presentation, are the parameters of the Hamiltonian that we don't want to go into details with at all. what I've shown here is the pulse that we use to implement this one unit J. So this controlled sigma 1 gate looks like this. It's really complicated. It is a 60 millisecond pulse, which is fairly long for liquid state NMR. This is a time axis and an amplitude axis. I've zoomed in on a little bit of it so that you can see. These are our X and Y control fields, the real and imaginary parts of this pulse. And it's pretty complicated, right? So we've numerically generated this using the GRAPE algorithm. And we've engineered it to have 0.998% fidelity, which is, you know, pretty good. It's going to do our pulse pretty much exactly. The problem with this is that this is pretty demanding. And when we actually ask our instruments to implement this, it doesn't do this exactly. We'd be really impressed if it could do this really precisely, right? So we actually have a way of measuring what the system is actually implementing through a feedback loop. And the fidelity of this pulse is actually more like 99%. So I said we designed it to have 99.8, but because of imperfections in the implementation, we only really come out with 99%. So pretty good, not too bad. All right, so this is an example of what our initial state in black and our final state in red is going to look like. I should note that they're not scaled. In reality, this red state is much smaller. This red signal is much smaller. The reason I'm mentioning this is that I have amplitude on this one axis, but it's fairly arbitrary. The units are completely dependent on how many molecules I have on my system, if I had, you know, a bigger sample or a less sample, more dilute. So the important thing is to have this reference pulse. And what I'm actually going to measure is the integral of this curve compared to the integral of the reference curve. And that's going to give me my answer. The reason I bother to mention this is because, like I said, I have these 60 millisecond pulses. And I'm doing three of them in a row, which brings me up to 180 milliseconds, which is pretty long. And in that time, my system loses a bit of its signal. So if I were to prepare my initial state and measure it right away, I'd get this dotted line. But if I implemented 180 milliseconds of identity pulses, pulses that are designed to just do the identity, I end up with this much polarization, right? So it actually proves to be really important in our experiment to compare it to the smaller, to the state that's been evolved for 180 milliseconds, right? We want our reference to have the exact same time scale as our actual experiment. And we can take a closer look at our final state, exactly like that red one I showed you a moment ago. The solid line is the experiment, and the dotted blue line is our simulation. The point of this is just to show you that our experiment and simulation match really well. We're doing a pretty good job. See that there's a little bit of differences in some of the height, peak heights. But, you know, we have a fairly complicated system, and we're evolving it for a long time, and we're pretty happy with this. The reason I show you this is because when we're interpreting the data, it gets a little bit more complicated. So what I've plotted here is all the Jones polynomials. This is the imaginary and the real axis. And we performed this for 18 different braids. And that corresponds to these 18 different data points. The circular points are the theoretical values, and these guys are the actual experimental values. So 18 different braids, for instance, you know, this is one, well, I'll give you the n-naught, like we saw, so sigma 1, sigma 2, inverse sigma 3, is going to be one of these three points. Sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3 will be another one of these points, right, that are supposed to be the exact same knot, but a different braid representation. So if you go back to the question that I asked at the very beginning, it was, can we distinguish between two knots? Right? So if you were to give me this knot right here and this knot right here and ask me, are they the same? I can plug them into my quantum computer and I can tell you, you know, I'm pretty sure they're different. Right? These knots are different. If you gave me, let's say, this one and this one, I wouldn't be so certain. Right? But if you look at this overall, we're doing really well. Now, I'll explain these shaded areas a little bit. What these shaded areas are the error ellipses based on the fact that we only have 99% fidelity in our pulses. So we expect it to be a little bit off, right? And this is kind of the error circle that we expect just from this 99% fidelity. Of course, as you can tell, we do have some systematic errors as well. They're a little bit harder to quantify. Okay. By looking at this, I'll talk about the errors while we're looking at the picture. There are two different types of errors we can have, right? One error is when I have this knot and this knot, and I say, you know what, I can't tell them apart. I don't really know that they're different. I'm not convinced, right? This is an error. I was wrong. The second type of error is, let's say if I had this guy and this guy. If you see, their error ellipses don't intersect. And because of that, I'm probably going to be inclined to say that these are different knots. This is a bigger error, right? I go from claiming wrong information. Well, in this case, I claimed no information. I said, I don't really know, right? I'm just going to, throw up my hands and say I'm not sure. In this case, I'm saying, they're different. These are different knots, and I'm completely wrong. So these are the two different types of errors I have. I like to call them passive errors and fatal errors. Fatal errors clearly being worse than passive errors. I probably didn't have to mention that. You kind of got it. But from this, we can define some sort of success probability, because I want to be able to say, I can distinguish knots of this type with this percent of success. So I derived this equation that says, okay, I have, in our case, I have 135 pairs of knots, of distinct knots. I'm going to minus the total number of errors that I made, both passive and fatal, and divide by the total number of distinct knots, and this is going to be my percent. So in the case over here, if we were just using the error ellipses as our way of saying they're distinct or not, I would only make one mistake. I would only, these two are the only circles that overlap that are for distinct knots. But I make three fatal errors. Right, three times I say these knots are different when they're really not. So, this one, this guy, and this guy. And there's one more somewhere. Oh yeah, this one and this one. So with this equation, I would say that I have a success probability of 97%. Right? But I'm not really happy with this, because like I said, I don't really want to make fatal errors. And at this point, I've given them the same weight. So I could say, maybe give a greater weight to fatal errors, maybe say they're twice as expensive as the passive errors, in which case my success probability would drop to 94%. And so, how I define my success is extremely variable, and it depends on what I want to be able to say. If I'd like to say I'd never make a mistake, that's very different than just saying, I have some errors. So, this is something I haven't really nailed down yet. I don't really know what I want to claim quite yet. So in conclusion, what I want you to get away from this talk, the first thing is that DQC1 can be used to evaluate the Jones polynomial at this one particular point. Something I didn't mention earlier, you might be wondering why we're calculating the Jones polynomial on a quantum computer, perhaps. It turns out it's very hard classically. Exact evaluation of the Jones polynomial is sharp P hard, which we learned about yesterday. And even evaluation at individual points is very difficult. It's been shown at some points to be BQP complete. At this one special point for the trace closure, it's DQC1 complete. It's a difficult problem. The second thing I want you to take away from this is that we've implemented this in liquid state NMR with 4 qubits, with 94-97% success. and to answer the question that I set out to answer at the very beginning, can we distinguish between two knots by approximating the Jones polynomial? Yeah. Right? For these particular class of knots, the ones with 4 strands, and I always used 3 crossings, I can tell most of them apart. And I would count this as a success. And that is it. Thank you.